Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Right now in Antarctica, it is still bitterly cold and a ferocious wind blows. Since it's summer there, the sun shines down on the ice for 24 hours a day. Polar explorers call it the white darkness. And somewhere across that white expanse, two human beings are walking across the continent. Colin O'Brady and Lewis Rudd are about a mile apart from each other, hoping to become the first person ever to walk more than 900 miles across Antarctica solo and unaided. Now, in 2016, another man, Henry Worsley, attempted the journey. He died in the trying. So there are always the questions: how, why, what drives a person to push themselves to the point where everything, all pretense, falls away? What is it about Antarctica that fuels that kind of spiritual hunger? This hour on Point, the story of Henry Worsley and the quest to walk across Antarctica. And you can join us. Are you following Colin O'Brady and Lewis Rudd's separate solo treks across Antarctica right now? Have you heard of the story of Henry Worsley? Would you ever have the desire, the willpower and stamina to drag yourself and a sled full of supplies across our southern continent? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a little later this hour, we will check in with one of the men now crossing Antarctica. We'll be speaking with Colin O'Brady's wife, who's managing his expedition. But first, I'm joined by David Gran. He's with us from Dallas, Texas today. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, The White Darkness. It's about Henry Worsley's fatal 2016 expedition. There's an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. David Gran, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
Your magazine piece and now this book was one of the most riveting things I have read all year long. So I am extremely delighted to talk with you. First of all, just tell us a little bit about how you got onto this story of Henry Worsley and his trek to cross Antarctica on foot in 2016.
Yeah. So I've always been interested in polar explorers ever since I was young. I used to read stories about them, but I always liked to read them preferably by a nice warm fire. And in 2015, I came across a story that Henry Worsley, a British man, was setting out to do what his hero had failed to do a century earlier. And his hero was Ernest Shackleton. And his mission was to try to trek from one side of Antarctica to the other. And whereas Shackleton had intended to be part of a large expedition, Worsley planned to do it solo, unaided and unsupported. And what that meant is he would have no food caches planted along his route to forestall starvation. And he would have to haul all of his supplies, all of his food on a sled without the aid of dogs or kites. And nobody had ever dared to do this before. So I was kind of immediately drawn to the story.
Wow. I mean, so we'll talk about Shackleton more later because he figures prominently in Henry Worsley's life. I mean, Shackleton, of course, most famous for a failed expedition. But
yes.
But can you just talk me through a little bit about what it means physically when we're talking about walking more than 900 miles across Antarctica, even though it's in the polar summer there? I mean, the conditions are extreme, to say the least.
Yeah, and I mean, it is one of the greatest feats of human endurance and tests of character. And to understand the conditions, you need to understand Antarctica, which is more like visiting Mars than it is most places on Earth. First of all, Antarctica is larger than Europe. It's 5.5 million square acres. And in the winter, the coast areas freeze, so it doubles in size. It is the windiest continent with winds reaching 100 miles per hour, regular gale force winds. Henry Worsley, Lew Rudd, Colin O'Brien, they're all facing those conditions. It is the coldest continent, with temperatures routinely reaching minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit. It is the highest continent. You know, people think of Antarctica as flat, but they're actually trekking uphill most of the time in elevation. And perhaps the strangest detail about Antarctica is that it is covered, 98% of it is covered in ice, which contains about 70% of all the fresh water on Earth. And yet Antarctica is also the driest continent because there is so little precipitation. But what happens is the wind kicks up that ice and creates these whiteouts. So these men and women who have tried to do these treks are reducing themselves almost to mules. They will hump through these conditions for 10, 11, 12, 15, 16 hours a day, hauling all their supplies, facing the prospect of starvation. And of course, one other challenge they all face, which is one misstep and they will plunge into a crevasse, into a hidden chasm.
Wow. I mean, the image of these individuals walking with a 300-plus pound sled of supplies strapped to them in a harness, dragging behind them. I mean, you describe it like a ship's anchor that they're pulling across the ice in whiteout conditions that are so violent and so cold that all they can do is look, like stare down at their chest on the compasses that are right on their chest so that they just know that every step they're just going south. They're just going south, at least in the first phase of the trip. It's almost unimaginable.
Yeah. I mean, one of the craziest things about these whiteouts is that they are so dense. As you say, all they can see is a compass, but they often can't tell which way is up or down. And they will fall over because they'll put their foot in the wrong direction because they're just enclosed in these fog of ice particles. One polar explorer who went with Henry Worsley on one of his first expeditions described it as being trapped inside a ping pong ball bouncing on a boisterous ocean.
Wow. Well, so right now in Antarctica, Lou Rudd and Colin O'Brady are enduring those conditions. And we'll hear more about them in a little bit. But David Graham, then, so tell us more about Henry Worsley. He died from trying to make this attempt in 2016 or make this trek. What drew him? What was that spiritual hunger in him that made him want to walk across Antarctica?
Yeah, I mean, ever since he was young, he used to read adventure stories. And one day he read a book by Ernest Shackleton. And Shackleton had described hearing the lure of little voices drawing you into the unknown. And Worsley had always heard those voices. And he longed to be a polar explorer. Finally, at age 47, he set out on his first expedition to try to walk to the South Pole. And I think he saw it as a test of endurance, a test of character. You know, one of the things that happens in Antarctica is a perfect laboratory for human dynamics. Now, in these latter expeditions, they did solo, but Worsley in his early expeditions went in a group. And on these group expeditions, you know, history is studded with accounts of explorers turning on each other, backstabbing, bickering. There's even cases of murder. So Worsley saw these as a test of leadership. And I also think there is a spiritual quality to these treks. And I think, as you said in the intro, I mean, it reduces them to their elements where their decisions involve life or death decisions. It concentrates the mind. I think Worsley was drawn to that. And Worsley talked about the paradox of Antarctica, which is on one level, you're acutely aware of your consciousness. You hear every breath. Every step you are cognizant of. And yet you are in this immense landscape in which you are also aware of your insignificance. And I think Worsley was drawn to that spiritual quality, that paradox of Antarctica.
Well, I actually just want to play a tiny bit of tape here about how from Henry Worsley himself on how he felt being in Antarctica. This is an audio message that he sent home via his sat phone. It was on the 67th day of his 2016 trek. Some of the dispatch is hard to understand, but let's listen to it.
This is marvelous to be here. It's been a very grueling expedition, grueling journey. The best message for me in my little tent is blowing a bit outside now. And it's probably in the minus 30s in winter.
Well, so that's Henry Worsley in 2016 on day 67 of his trip walking across Antarctica. And he says, David, it feels marvelous to be here.
Yeah, and you can hear, but you can hear the weakening of his voice. And to some degree, toward the end of that expedition, and that those solo treks, that was the hardest thing Henry had ever done. I mean, he had done two other treks to the South Pole. He was the only person to ever trace the two classic routes to the South Pole. He was considered a pioneer of the possible. He was a revered British officer. He was somebody who had never given up, who always adhered to Shackleton's family motto, "By endurance we conquer." And he loved Antarctica, but even though he said it was the most marvelous place, you can hear it in his voice by day 67. It was taking a tremendous toll on him. It was his longest, hardest, most punishing journey. And being alone, which is something he had not done before and which added so many new challenges, he had to survive entirely by his own wits.
Yeah. Well, let's compare the frailty of the voice of Worsley we just heard with a video that he recorded in England before he took off on his solo expedition, explaining what his morning routines would be like in Antarctica.
So a few words about my daily routine. So I will be up at 7 o'clock in the morning. And the first thing I'll do is probably pop outside to go to the loo. Essentially, it's digging a hole and doing it, but you do it very quickly, face it into and away from the wind, depending on which level of ablution you are undertaking. Okay, so back in the tent, on the cooker goes, and I'm straight into melting snow in my 5-litre kettle, which will produce water, which will cook my porridge, and will also fill my 2 thermos flasks for my drinking and liquids during the day.
Well, that's Henry Worsley in a video he recorded in England well before he began his ill-fated Antarctic expedition in 2016. We'll talk more about what happened to Worsley. We'll talk more about his hero, Ernest Shackleton. And we will check in with the 2 treks that are going on right now in Antarctica, Colin O'Brady and Lewis Rudd trying to walk across that icy continent. Would you have the stamina, the fortitude, the desire to push yourself to, past all pretense, to walk across Antarctica? What's your question for those who undertake such a quest? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with David Gran. He's staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, The White Darkness. It is about the 2016 expedition that Henry Worsley undertook to walk more than 900 miles, walk solo and unaided across Antarctica. And we want to hear from you. What's your question for those who would undertake such a quest? And what is it about Antarctica and its white darkness, as David Gran's book title tells us? What is it about that continent that produces this spiritual hunger for exploration? David, so let's go way back in time here, because Henry Worsley was inspired by Ernest Shackleton. And first of all, Worsley has a family connection to that great 20th century British explorer.
Yeah, Henry was thrilled to discover that one of his distant relatives had been a member of probably Shackleton's most famous expedition, the Endurance Expedition.
Okay, and that the Endurance Expedition was in the 19-teens, right?
Yes, that is correct. Early 20th century, 1914 is when they set out.
Okay, but Shackleton's earlier experience on the Antarctic, we have a little bit of tape here from Shackleton in 1909 recounting his Antarctic expedition, which he undertook with the Robert Scott one was even earlier than that, so we'll get to that. There's a lot of journeys here, but this is Shackleton talking about his 1909 Antarctic expedition and explaining why he and his team had to turn back just before reaching the South Pole.
"We reached a point within 97 geographical miles of the South Pole The only thing that stopped you from reaching the actual point was the lack of 50 pounds of food. We made many interesting geological and scientific discoveries and had many narrow escapes throughout the whole time.
So that was Ernest Shackleton in 1909 saying how on one of his journeys to the South Pole, they had to stop within 97 nautical miles of the pole. And the only thing that stopped them was lacking 50 pounds of food. So David Grant, first of all, tell us about Shackleton himself. What was his earliest experience in Antarctica?
Yeah, so Shackleton is revered as one of the greatest leaders, not just of polar exploration, but in general. He's often studied. But in many ways, he was a failure, which is what I think makes him so interesting. In 1901, he had hoped to reach the South Pole with Robert Falcon Scott to be the first party, but starving, frostbitten, suffering from scurvy, they were forced to turn back. Then he embarked on his own expedition, hoping to reach the South Pole. And you played that tape, which is just incredible to hear. And they got within 97 nautical miles of the South Pole. And they were depleted. He knew at that point he could actually reach the South Pole and become the first person to ever do so. But he would have to deplete a lot of his food. He was worried about the welfare of his men. And so he made this anguishing decision, which was to turn back only 97 miles from the pole. When he got back to England, he didn't discuss his failure, but he said to his wife just one line. It's a line that Henry Worsley would later repeat. And he said to his wife, better a live donkey than a dead lion. And I thought that really captures part of Shackleton's ethos. And then, of course, he embarked on a later expedition in 1914, hoping to trek across Antarctica. But his ship, the Endurance, got frozen in the ice and sank. And Shackleton found himself stranded on an ice floe more than 1,000 miles from the closest inhabited island. He did not have a radio to signal for help, and he had to figure out a way to get all of his men back to safety. And incredibly, I mean, it really is one of the greatest survival stories in history. Through his powers of endurance and through his uncanny leadership, he managed to get them all back and rescue them alive.
Well, so we need to talk about this for a second because, you know, for a while, history sort of relegated Shackleton to the status of failure because he didn't, you know, succeed, quote unquote, succeed in that particular Antarctic voyage. But his story is one of wild success against, well, almost insurmountable odds, right? Because when the Endurance was frozen into the sea ice, didn't they spend almost a year on board the ship sort of drifting in Antarctic waters before they could make their next move? Or at least many months, I think, right?
Yes, nearly a year. Yes. So after when the ship first got frozen in the ice and they got stuck about 100 miles from their designated base camp on Antarctica, and winter was coming. And winter in Antarctica, where there's 24 hours of light in summer, there's 24 hours of darkness in the winter, and the temperatures fall even more. And so Shackleton knew that he and his men would be trapped on that boat until the November melt when the ice began to thin. And this is where Shackleton showed his leadership abilities. He ignored the stifling hierarchies of class and naval rank. He made sure that every member in the ship participate in the same chores, share in the same food. He also he always preached optimism and patience, and he created in that dreadful period when they were trapped on the ship during the tedium and dread, this playful atmosphere where the men would play cards, music would waft through the berths on a phonograph. And he really understood, as actually Henry Worsley's ancestor had said, who was captain of that ship, Frank Worsley, you know, he said that Shackleton understood how the psychology of one could affect the whole group. So he was always concerned about the psychology of this unit and how to lead them. And then rather than having the ice melt, the ship eventually sank. And so then they were trapped again on an ice floe.
Wow. Trapped on an ice floe. Then they then they drag the lifeboats they have to another place on an ice shelf. And then Shackleton with a couple of his men get in one of the boats and go to South Georgia Island.
Well, first they go to so it's kind of amazing. So first they try to drag these lifeboats. Each one weighed a ton. And again, Shackleton showing his kind of abilities, setting the example as a leader. They had to abandon their most precious items, and so he set the example. He took his Bible, which had been inscribed by the queen before he set out. He lays it on the ground, and he lays it with his several sovereign gold coins, and then others follow suit and try to drag these boats. But the ships are too heavy, and so eventually they have to wait, and they just camp on this ice till it eventually cracks under their feet. And then they launch in these boats, and they get to Elephant Island
Elephant Island, that's right.
Which is just this barren speck of rock. It's still about 800 miles from South Georgia Island, which actually has a whaling station. That's where they need to get to. And Shackleton realized that many of the members of his crew would not survive a longer journey. One of the men had to have 5 frostbitten toes amputated in primitive fashion on Elephant Island. So Shackleton takes just a few men, including Henry Worsley's ancestor, Frank Worsley, in one of the boats. And incredibly, they go through these in this small open boat through a hurricane, through enormous waves. Their hairs and bodies are frozen with ice. They're frostbitten. And Shackleton's doling out bits of food to keep them conscious. And eventually they reach South Georgia Island, and you would think that it would end there, but no. They are on the wrong side of the island.
So they have to hike 26 miles to the other side of the island.
Yeah, over an uncharted glacier. Eventually they do get to the whaling station and are able to get a boat eventually and go back to Elephant Island and rescue the rest of the party.
I mean, this is a period of months, right? Because he had to wait till August to go back to Elephant Island. I mean, you can only imagine what the men at the whaling station thought when they saw these spectral versions of humans approaching them over the ice and what Shackleton and his men had endured. So, and nevertheless, even after this trial, beyond all trials, Shackleton wanted to go back to Antarctica. And it was that his later mission that Worsley wanted to recreate in his attempt to walk across the continent?
So it was actually the Endurance Expedition.
The Endurance Expedition, okay.
Yeah. So Shackleton's plan in the Endurance Expedition was to try to trek across Antarctica. That was the goal as part of a large party.
But he never could get started, right?
He didn't even get to the shore. He never made it to the shore of Antarctica.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick call here. Phyllis is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Phyllis, you're on the air.
Well, Shackleton was truly a hero. I mean, at a time when Scott lost all his men because of really stupid leadership decisions, Shackleton saved all of his men. And it didn't matter to him whether he made the final trek to the pole. It mattered to him whether his men lived, and they did.
Right. So you're talking about Robert Scott, who Shackleton had gone
lost
with
all his men.
Yeah, in 1911, right? And the same year that Norwegian Roald Amundsen,
who actually made the
successful trip to the South Pole.
Right, but because Scott insisted on taking ponies. And you notice in the Arctic how much grass there is to feed ponies.
Right
then and there, you've got to know that this is a bad leader.
Well, but oh no, Phyllis, go ahead.
Hero. I mean, he was truly a hero. He took 2 people with him. He walked across the island. They even built a house, by the way. I think they took one of the boats and managed to build a house to house the men while they waited for rescue.
Yeah.
And it was truly a remarkable undertaking.
Yeah.
I don't understand about this fellow who went by himself. I mean, unless he had a very strong death wish. But that's another matter.
Well, Phyllis, I'm going to just take it back from there. Thank you so much for your call. David Grant, Henry Worsley didn't have a death wish. It ended up costing his life in 2016. But respond to what she's saying there, that Shackleton should be seen as a hero, whereas others like Robert Scott, who died in 1911, you quote him as saying, "We shall die like gentlemen," because they ran out of food.
He wrote in his diary before he died. So what's very interesting about heroes is they often tell us as much about ourselves and the societies as about the people who we venerate. And what was interesting is after Scott died in that race with Amundsen to the South Pole, in which Amundsen beat Scott by 33 days, Scott, can you imagine, he gets to the South Pole, and what does he see? He sees Amundsen's Norwegian flag and tent, yeah. And he knows he's been beaten. And then he has to turn around and go back. And, of course, they run out of food, and they perish. He's with four other men, and they all perish. And after his death, he was the one, much more than Shackleton, who was venerated by British society. He was kind of seen as a martyr. England at that time was during the beginning of the decline of the British Empire. Also during World War I, when there was all this sacrifice, almost senseless sacrifice, Scott was the one who was revered and not Shackleton. And it really wasn't until the 1970s where there is a resurgence of interest in Shackleton. And in an age in which we as a society tend to venerate the mastery over battlefields, over businesses, over you name it, especially over ourselves, that Shackleton became revered for the way he recruited his men, mm-hmm. and the way he coolly guided them to safety. And there's a whole subgenre of literature now about Shackleton, about how to learn to lead like Shackleton.
Yeah. Well, let's return to the present day, to right now, because there are two men who are attempting to walk across Antarctica as we speak. Colin O'Brady and Lewis Rudd are trying to do this. And joining us now is Jenna Besaw. She's with us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. She's managing Colin O'Brady's expedition operations and the media campaign. She's married to Colin O'Brady. Today is day 17 of his trek, and you can track his progress, by the way, online. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Jenna Besaw, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great delight to have you. So first of all, where is Colin and how is he doing?
Fantastic question. Colin actually is on day 17, as you just mentioned, and he's actually hit a pretty notable point on the journey. So he started off at the Messner starting point on the Rhön ice shelf, and he has just turned the corner at Beals Mountain. So that puts him pretty much due south to the South Pole now, on track to the journey.
Wow. And so how much space is he, or how much distance is he covering a day on average?
So on average, we have actually strategically planned it out so that he has a clear progression on what he needs to accomplish. Right now, he's averaging around 14 to 16 miles per day. Yesterday was particularly hard with the headwinds as he made that corner. So it was a shorter day on mileage, but a great mental perseverance day. So he's out there for about 10 to 12 hours a day pushing his body.
Wow. Okay. So we have a lot of people who want to know sort of nitty gritty details of how one prepares and pulls off an expedition like this. Someone calling themselves Woozy Canary says, as someone who does more typical hiking or backpacking, even in winter, it'd be fascinating to hear the operational details of what's necessary. So, for example, Jenna, how did Colin prepare himself physically and mentally to do this?
Yeah, so Colin has been an elite endurance athlete for the past decade. So he was a triathlete for many years, and then he transitioned his body and mind into the mountains. So really, he's been training for this body and mind for many years in preparation. He worked with a very specific trainer in Portland, Oregon, where we live, Mike McCassell, who did a very unique training regimen around putting his hands and feet in ice buckets so that he could mentally see if he, during fatigue, would be able to make critically important decisions. And, you know, we worked with a supplement company, Standard Process, who very specialized looked at his diet to make sure everything would be in line for the caloric need while he's out there. So a lot of preparation and planning went into making this hopefully a success.
Yeah, customized protein bars, right, so they'll have everything he needs, because he's probably burning thousands and thousands of calories every single day. What else is in his sled, and how big and heavy is his sled?
So Colin's sled started at about 375 pounds, so quite a behemoth. mostly that really compromises food and fuel. So we planned for a 65-day ration, which his sled will deplete about 3.5 pounds every day. And in addition to that, he's got all the necessities for, a safe journey, his tent and a lot of medical equipment just in case anything goes wrong out there, and mostly food and fuel for the solo journey.
We've got to take a quick break here. Can you hang on for a minute or two, Jenna, because I have a couple more questions for you, if that's okay.
Absolutely, no problem.
Okay, great. Well, we are talking about past and current expeditions in attempts to walk solo and unaided across Antarctica, and what draws people, a very select group of people, mind you, but what draws them to undertake this kind of grueling test. Jenna Besaw is with us. She is managing the expedition currently undertaken by Colin O'Brady, who's trying to walk across the continent. Lewis Rudd is doing that now as well. David Gran is with us. He wrote about the 2016 expedition that Henry Worsley undertook. David Gran's new book is The White Darkness. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about quests to walk solo and unaided across Antarctica. Two men are attempting to do that right now, Lewis Rudd and Colin O'Brady. Jenna Besaw joins us. She's married to Colin O'Brady and is managing expedition operations for his current trek across Antarctica. David Gran is also with us. He's written about a 2016 attempt that was made by Henry Worsley. He writes about that in the new book, The White Darkness. And here's a little bit of tape, a short video of Colin O'Brady he posted to his Instagram site almost a month ago, as Colin lies in bed for the last time before he sets off on his expedition.
Well, time to leave home and head for Chile and then Antarctica. It's my last night in the sleep number. It's been so good sleeping in this bed as I prep for Antarctica, and I'll be missing it a lot when I'm in the frozen desert sleeping on the ground.
That's Colin O'Brady before he set off for Antarctica. Jenna Besaw, how's Colin? I mean, have you been able to talk to Colin now that since he's on day 17 of his trek?
Hi, yes. I am very fortunate in that satellite technology allows us to stay connected. So I do check in with him every evening, which is also when I receive the daily Instagram update. It's quite challenging out there, a lot of hard obstacles, but he sounds great. He actually sounds better on day 17 than he did on day one, I have to admit. So we're happy with his progress.
Well, very glad to hear that. I mean, just hearing his voice there before he left about enjoying his last night in the sleep number mattress before sleeping in the, as he called it, the frozen desert. I just want to ask you, Jenna, we're spending this hour talking about what Colin and Lewis are trying to do right now, but with being mindful of the story that David Gran is telling us about Henry Worsley's attempt in 2016. And as we know, Henry died trying to make that attempt. I mean, do you worry? I mean, you must worry about Colin. And just how do you manage your concern that what he's trying to do is could bring him to the edge?
Sure. I have deepest respect and empathy and compassion for Worsley's family, a dear tragedy. Colin has spent the last decade as an elite endurance athlete, and from a physical perspective, I have complete faith in his endurance and ability to know his body really well. Again, the best success for this project will be a safe and healthy completion, whether or not that means the finish line. Of course, the finish line is the trophy, but you know, there's no need for Colin to push beyond his boundaries. That said, he really stands for unlocking human potential and understanding where his boundaries lie. Not just for himself, but really to inspire others to live active and healthy lives and pursue their biggest dreams. And for Colin, that is all about, you know, the physical endeavor and seeing what happens in his mind during these projects. So this project is really for everyone who's been told their dreams are impossible. So, yeah, he's out there trying to conquer all that.
Well, Jenna Bisaw, she's married to Colin O'Brady, who right now is attempting to walk across Antarctica. She's managing expedition operations for that trip. And we have a link to our website, onpointradio.org, where you can track Colin's progress online. So, Jenna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great day.
Well, David Gran, let me turn back to you here. And I just want to play a little bit of tape, first of all, because we have to talk about what ended up happening to Henry Worsley in 2016. So I'll play a bit of tape here. This is day 66 of Worsley's 2016 expedition, and you can hear he's beginning to lose his strength, but he says he's determined to go on.
Well, in some, it's been a punishing day. All was looking good at the outset, although an 80% whiteout persisted all day. Cruelty, though, the very soft snow. It was hellish all day. Weaker now, of course, it was the last thing I needed. And it saps what little energy I have left straight out of my now very skinny legs into the cold air.
That's Henry Worsley on day 66 of his 2016 expedition. David Gran, at the end of this sequence, this little audio that he sent back, you hear him say it's hellish. It was a cruel day. It sapped what little energy he had left. But he's going to get up at 5:30 to repeat and progress. And that is what I have to do, and do it I will. Where was he in the journey when he was saying that?
Yeah, so I mean, Henry really was a remarkable man, and you know, you hear his voice, and there's a real person there, you know, and you know, he was someone I really came to admire in writing about him. I mean, he was a revered British Army officer. He was an amateur historian who had become an expert on polar exploration, and he really was one of the great polar explorers of our time. And on this expedition, everything basically had gone wrong. It was just like with Shackleton's Endurance. I mean, he just faced one whiteout after the other. The temperatures were awful. And incredibly, he kept going. He had remarkable powers of endurance. And you hear that in his voice there. At that point, he was closing in on the end of his journey. He had gone close to 800 miles. He only had about 100 more miles to go. But his body was also getting closer to being on the verge of collapse. And within a few more days, his fingers were almost frostbite. His arms throbbed. His legs throbbed. His toenails were discolored. His front tooth had fallen out, and the wind whistled through the gap like as if he were a pirate. And he had to reckon with this great decision, and that was what to do when he was so close to the end. And he would always ask himself whenever he was in peril, what would Shackleton do? And in this situation, he was in more danger than he would ever be in when he asked that question.
Well, we have Worsley asking this question out loud on day 71, when he decided he could go no further. And here's what he said.
On the morning of January the 9th, 1909, he said he'd shot his bolt. Well, today, I have to inform you, with some sadness, that I too have shot my bolt. My journey is at an end. I have run out of time, as they could observe. In a simple chair and ability to slide one ski in front of the other. No matter. I'll lick my wounds. I will heal over time. I will come to terms with the disappointment.
That's Henry Worsley on day 71 of his trek. David Grand, so the lesson that Worsley took from Shackleton at that moment wasn't the, you know, the call to endurance beyond all, but it was when to know when to turn back.
Yeah. Often when we think about Shackleton, we think about his family motto, which was by endurance we conquer. But I think there's a deeper meaning to Shackleton, and I think Worsley reckoned with that and understood that in that moment, which is that not everything can be conquered, least of all Antarctica. And there are times to reckon with our human limitations, which is really in some ways far harder than always triumphing. And I think Worsley understood in that moment that there was triumph and defeat. There was the triumph of survival itself. And so he had a satellite phone, as Colin's wife was describing. And he summoned a search and rescue plane, what Worsley joked was the most expensive taxi ride in the world.
How sick was he? I mean, he ended up being airlifted back to Chile, right?
Yeah, he called his wife. He says, I'm having a cup of tea and I'll call you the next day. I'm going to be fine. And he really, he was amongst everything, he was a devoted father and a devoted family man. He was not aware that he had an infection in the tissue of his abdomen. He was flown and medevaced to a hospital in Chile. And there the doctors discovered this. They rushed him into a surgery. Very tragically, he went into septic shock. The infection spread into his bloodstream. His organs began to fail, and he died of complete organ failure before his wife was able to get to him.
Wow. And as you said, he was so close. He was at the tail end of this 900-mile solo trek.
He was so close, and he was somebody who had never given up. And he had in many ways, you know, believed in the notion of you can always will yourself past. And he had never failed at anything before. He was a member of the SAS, which is an elite commando unit, very much like our U.S. Delta Force. And he would always repeat the SAS's unofficial motto, which was, always a little further, always a little further. And he would repeat that as a mantra. And so the grail, his grail was so close. But in that moment, he reckoned with his limitations and he did summon that plane. And as his wife said, he chose us. And the great tragedy was that he died even after that.
Well, let's go to Nathan, who's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hey, Magna. I just want to talk for a second about the feelings I'm filled with when I heard about this. I can't believe I didn't know about it before now, but these two gentlemen going across the most desolate, barren land that this planet has to offer, it's a truly profound thing, and it feels like so often today, especially in these days, that like all frontiers have been explored, like that there's nothing left, of course, with the exception of space, but you know, we'll get there. So to hear about this, these two men on this adventure, if you will, it's unbelievable. And I can't even imagine the physical requirements as well as the emotional requirements, because it's not, you know, the Appalachian Trail. There's the sky and the ice, and I guess that's it. And like to truly confront yourself, like hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the next human being. This is the quintessence of humanity.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, let me take it back from you there, because really interesting phrase you used, to confront yourself, and I'd say thousands of miles from humanity. David Grand, is that, I mean, something that Henry Worsley was trying to do, to confront something within
him? Yeah, you know, and that was such a great comment that the caller made, because it is this barren, desolate space. In Worsley's first expedition, which he trace Shackleton's route to the South Pole, and he wanted to get to the 97-mile mark, and then from there continue on to the South Pole. And when he got to the 97-mile mark, this place that had kind of filled his imagination and filled his dreams and almost lured him to his demise, he looked around, and what did he see? Absolutely nothing. Just barren, windswept ice in this majestic deathscape. And one of Worsley's companions said, "What is Antarctica other than a blank space upon which to impose yourself?" So these are, in many ways, inward quests. I mean, the outward object is no more than a geographical data point in the middle of the nothingness. And I do think Worsley wanted to confront himself in the sense of he saw it as a test of his character, a test of his mind. And there was a almost a spiritual element to these journeys for him.
But, you know, I don't want to overly romanticize this at all, because obviously it cost him his life. And as you write, his family wasn't – they were supportive, but it created some rifts with his family as well too, because he was a father and a husband as well. You know, like so they were part of this picture too.
Yeah, I mean, these expeditions do have real life consequences. And Henry Worsley, you know, was frank about that and wrote about that these passions tipped into obsessions. And often the people who suffer were the people left behind. And he was cognizant of that. And early on, for example, for his son, you know, he didn't understand why his father would do these treks, why he would be away. But over time, he really came to admire his father. And it's interesting. Worsley would always ask himself, what would Shackleton do? And Max Worsley today, who's Henry's son, he asks himself, what would Dad do? What would Dad do?
Huh. Well, let's try to see if we can get one more call in here. Peter is calling from New Orleans. Peter, you're on the air. We've got about a minute and a half left, but go ahead.
Thank you. I'm happy to hear what inspires people to do these trips in this day and age, because particularly talking about Shackleton, I was thinking about the people who were even there before Shackleton. I read through the first Antarctic Night, and they were explorers. Today, I view these people primarily as adventurers, but now I'm hearing that these people really want to inspire, and they're going to learn about what the limits of human endurance are, and also to honor their predecessors. And it's that latter thing is particularly touching to me.
Mm. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your call. And we had another caller who looks like she's gone now. But David, we had another caller who wanted to remind us about Helen Thayer, who became the first woman to travel solo to the magnetic North Pole, pulling her own sled and without resupply. So the caller wanted to give a hat tip to the women out there who are also enduring extreme conditions to travel to the Earth's most foreboding places. But we've got just 30 seconds here to go. David, what your final thought on our drive to attempt these crossings in places like Antarctica?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's interesting is Lewis Rudd who's doing the solo trek right now, had been with Worsley on a second expedition. But I do hope that all of them reckon with their limitations if that moment comes, because that is the most important thing, which is to come back.
Well, David Grann, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, The White Darkness. We have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. David Grann, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, let us know what you think. Go to onpointradio.org for that excerpt, as I said, and also drop us a comment on what you heard this hour. Would you attempt to undertake a quest like that? And why do you think people seek to do it? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.